Okay, so Hebrews chapter 5, please. Hebrews chapter 5. We're going to consider Jesus and his qualifications in Hebrews chapter 5. The writer has already introduced us to the concept of Jesus as our high priest. Do you remember that happening early on in the book of Hebrews? Hebrews chapter 2, verse 17 is where the mention of Jesus being our high priest, a mention, one of the early first mentions of Jesus being our high priest was made. Then, of course, it continues in chapter 3, and now's as good a time as any to remind us that these chapters and verses were not a part of the original construction of the letter. These chapters and verses were added many, many, many years later to facilitate our study of the scriptures, and I, for one, am thankful for these chapters and verses. It would be an awfully hard thing to do this morning to get all of us at the place of Hebrews chapter 5, verse 1, if we didn't have these chapters and verses. So it's a tool, it's an aid, and it's a very good aid for the most part. There are some occasions where a verse breaks and we're left thinking, well, the thought doesn't end there, only the verse ends there. Ditto chapters too, right? The thought doesn't stop at the end of chapter 2. The thought continues into chapter 3, so we kind of blow right past that somewhat arbitrary chapter break, and we pick up in chapter 3, verse 1, where yet again, Jesus is being referred to as our high priest. And so this is a theme that we will be returning to throughout our study of the book of Hebrews. And we actually return to it now in chapter 5, where we consider the office of the high priest. We consider the qualifications of the high priest. And we lay over the consideration of those things, Jesus and his superior ability to meet these qualifications, to exceed these qualifications, and in a word, to be better. Remember, we mentioned as we study the book of Hebrews that a major, major theme in the book is going to be better, showing that Jesus is better, and that purpose was to convince these Christians. And give me just a one or two sentence background on these Christians. We said these folks were what? Yeah, Jewish. They had a Jewish background, right? So these Christians were former Jews. They were converts to the Jewish faith. Nobody at this time was raised in a Christian home. It was too new for any of that to have actually happened with these folks. So they were converts to the Christian faith with a Jewish background, and so their temptation was to return back to what was familiar, to go back to the law of Moses, the Old Testament system. And so the writer of Hebrews is structuring his argumentation and his reasoning to cut off all the passes, right? I feel like if you want to go back to the law of Moses, you might think about this. And so I'm going to take this idea away from you. And I feel like if you want to go back to the law of Moses, you might want to talk about this. I'm going to take this idea away from you. Macy has written a few argumentative essays. and that's kind of the approach, right? If you do that well, you want to anticipate what an argument will be and then kind of take it out before it becomes an issue. So the writer of Hebrews is doing that with the assistance of inspiration. So this is not just his argumentative essay. This is the Lord's word coming through him. Every high priest is taken from where? Verse 1, chapter 5. Every high priest is taken from where? From among men, specifically, Sam, from the tribe of Levi. That's right. Well, there's your problem number one, isn't it, right? Here is a distinguishing mark of the Mosaic system. The high priests were men, and not men as opposed to women. They were male, but they were men, contrasted with deity. These folks were just regular guys like us, right? And that meant there were some built-in, you know, frailties, some built-in shortcomings. What are a few things that's wrong with us people, just kind of automatically? What are a few things that's wrong with us? That's not, we have sin, right? If you look ahead, there we go in chapter 5, verses 2 and 3. That's the big one, isn't it? These high priests would go in and they would offer sacrifices and gifts for sins, for their sins, right? Look at verse number 3. Because of this, he is required, as for the people, also for himself to offer sacrifices for sins. So there's, you know, shortcoming number one, right? These men had their own sins for which they had to atone. And that had to happen first, you know. These men had to come and offer sacrifices for themselves so that they could be pure in their officiating for the people's sins. So if you can imagine a system where the high priest is sinless, would that be a better system or a worse system than this Old Testament one that we're reading about? Be a better one, right? It would be a better one. Also, this will be alluded to here in chapter 5, but we're really going to sink our teeth into it in chapter 7. The human high priest also died, right? So the high priest had to be swapped out ever so often due to death. So if you could have a high priest who never dies, would that be better or worse than this Old Testament system? Be better, right? And that's where the writer is taking us. We're considering Jesus in every chapter. Chapter 5, we're considering Jesus' qualifications, and we're contrasting his ability, that's Jesus' ability, with the regular old high priest. Because this was the choice that these readers were making every day. Am I going to stick with Jesus, or should I go back and follow this Old Testament Mosaic system? So the writer's anticipating what might be their draw to this Old Testament system, and he's saying, in every regard, in every way that you think this Law of Moses way is good, this Christian way is better. Okay? Thoughts or comments or questions before we take in a few other verses? Look at verse number 5. Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest. In other words, maybe back up just a hair. This position of priest, this position of high priest, I'm glad you're sitting down for this, because this is going to knock your socks off, right? This position of priest, this position of high priest, because men were involved, became a little political, right? This position of priest, this position of high priest became corrupted, you know. Corruption was a real thing. Thankfully, we don't have to worry with anything like that happening today. Haha, right? No, of course we can see. Of course we can see how politicized this might be, how corrupted this system might be. So it was an old guy's club in some respects, right? And so the high priest would be selected, and there would be bribes, and there would be quid pro quos, and there would be, hey, you know, we need to get this guy in here because, well, everybody likes him. There would be stuff like that going on. And there would be ambition to be the high priest, and this ambition to be the high priest wasn't always for the right motives. So what we're learning about Christ's ascension to high priest is that it really wasn't an ascension at all. Jesus occupied a position above the high priest before he became the high priest. And that never happened, right? Nobody ever started the game above the position of the high priest. During Moses' time, under the tutelage of the law of Moses, nobody ever had a position above the high priest and then stepped down, condescended to the role of the high priest. That never happened except with Jesus making him what? Making him better in that sense. Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest. This was not a promotion for Christ. Christ was in the beginning with God. Hebrews chapter 1 lets us know that. Christ is the brightness of God's glory, the express image of his purpose. Christ, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3, upholds how many things? By the word of his power. All things by the word of his power. So this duty of being a priest was not a promotion for Jesus. It wasn't something that he aspired to. Jesus took this role on, but he took this role on out of a sense of duty, for the best reasons. Jesus became the high priest for the most noblest cause. He became the high priest, and that is to do the services of the high priest, to intercede between sinful us and sinless God. Jesus left heaven, so Jesus is already over here on God's side. And he sees us over here on man's side. And there's a great big old gap between us and God. Remember, sins do what? Separate us from God. So Jesus, already over here with God in heaven, he leaves that post and comes, and he's with us over here on the human side of things. He doesn't lose his deity. He retains his deity from over there. And now Jesus is in the middle of God and man. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15, we closed that section last week, but again, the thought that we're talking about has been on the mind really since chapter 2. You know, it hasn't gone anywhere. It's been right here all this time. And Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15 says that we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weakness. What's that mean? Jesus understands us, right? You just mark through these two knots. We do have a high priest who can sympathize with our weakness. Well, how can Jesus sympathize with our weakness? He's God. Yeah, he's God. But he became flesh. And he did that. He did that not because that was a promotion for him. He did that not because that was, you know, the next step in the rung of his career ladder. Jesus, who was God, became man so that he could serve as our capable high priest. Based on that, Hebrews chapter 4, verse 16, based on that, we have what with God? We have peace with God. Okay, I like that, Sam. We have confidence, right? We have boldness with God. We are able to approach God not with timidity, not with fear, even though we know that, you know, God is higher and more superior than we are. We approach God with boldness, not because, you know, we're so good. You know, we approach God with boldness because of Jesus. And it was the function of the high priest to bring the people and God together. And Jesus is doing this in a more excellent way. He is doing this in a superior way because he is the best high priest that anyone could ever hope for. Pardon me. So this role of high priest was not politicized with Jesus. He wasn't willing and dealing to become the high priest. He didn't want to become the high priest for any self-aggrandizement. He wanted to become the high priest because of the importance of the duty, right? So his motives are pure. His ambition is for us, for the purpose of the job of being high priest, not any kind of selfish ambition. And he was made high priest by God. Who made the high priest? This is kind of a splitting hairs question, so be ready for it. Who made the high priest under the Mosaic system? Who I don't want to use the word coronated because I don't exactly know how they did it, but who made the high priest in the Mosaics? And Moses was a man, right? A very great man, don't get me wrong. But that's the answer I was looking for, Sam. So we had humans making other humans high priest under the Mosaic system. And that's not a knock to the Mosaic system. I mean, that's just the way it was, right? I mean, how else could it have happened? So we're definitely not putting down the Old Testament. In Churches of Christ, we get this very, very bad, unfair rap of not believing in the Old Testament. Well, that's not true, right? We absolutely believe in the Old Testament and exalt that law for what it was. Now, what that law was a schoolmaster. Thank you, Brian. It was a tool. It was less than perfect, but I'm not saying that because I could have done any better. I'm saying the Old Testament law was less than perfect because that's the way God made it. And the reason why God made it that way, well, you know, we could have an elaborate discussion about the reason why God made the Old Testament law imperfect. But at the end of the day, God made the Old Testament law imperfect so that the perfection of the New Testament system could be more demonstrably seen, so that the perfection of the New Testament could be shown in comparison with the Old Testament system. Absolutely, Sam. And I hope that's what we're all getting from this first little paragraph of Hebrews chapter 5 here. We're considering Jesus. Of course, that's what we're doing in every chapter. But we're really sinking our teeth into the nuance, and I don't mean that in some, you know, elitist sort of way. We're sinking our teeth into the sophistication of the Hebrew writer's point here. He's drawing these visual images that really would pop in the minds of these first readers. Us, I mean, we're hundreds of years, thousands of years in some cases, away from Old Testament priesthood stuff. So this is not as fresh on our mind as it would be to theirs. But when the writer is talking about this high priest, he knows what he's doing. And he's talking about the high priest being selected from among men, offering sacrifices and gifts for his sins first. He's being subject to weakness, verse 2. He seeks this position with some human sense of pride and honor, even if it was way, way, way down there suppressed. That's a flaw with us humans. But Christ, D, none of the above, right? Christ, not selected from among men, doesn't have to offer sacrifices for his sins. He was not made a high priest by man. Christ was made a high priest by whom? God, right? Chapter 5, verse 5. You are my son. This day have I begotten you. We've heard that already in chapter 1. So the plot thickens, the argumentation continues, and the writer of Hebrews is expecting you to pack your bags and be ready for the journey that he's taking us on. So he shares with us this verse from Psalm 2, verse 7 in chapter 1 to show the deity of Christ and to portray Jesus in chapter 1 as God's messenger. Remember, that was our study of chapter 1. And now he hangs on to this same verse and uses it again here to show that God is the one, God's the one, not some man, even a great man like Moses. Moses, by the way, was a what? Chapter 3. Was he a son or was he a servant? He was a servant. Moses, by the way, was he over the house that God made or in the house that God made? In the house. So Moses, as great as he was, is not God. So Jesus being made a high priest by God, now that's something. That's better, isn't it? You're waking up in, you know, AD 55-ish, 60, I don't know. You're waking up in AD 62 or 3 or 4-ish, and you're rubbing the sleep out of your eyes. You can't wait for somebody to come along and invent the Keurig, which I was a late adopter to the Keurig. Now I'm sold, man. I like them. But you're waking up in AD 65, rubbing the sleep out of your eyes, and you're asking yourself, am I going to keep on doing this Christian system? Am I going to keep on doing this? Or is today going to be the day that I go back to my family's way, that I go back to my friends who are all following Moses? Is today the day that I'm going to do this or not? And then you think, well, pros and cons, right? We'll take a piece of paper and draw on pros and cons, and you're seeing everything is leading you to this Christian way. And hopefully, you know, that is going to provide the oomph, that's going to provide the encouragement, that's going to provide the help to stay with Christ. You are my son, today have I begotten you. Psalm 2, verse 7, spoken about Jesus, connecting Jesus to God from the beginning. And in another place, talking about priests and priesthoods, you are a priest forever after the order of whom? Melchizedek. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Who in the days of his flesh, the writer continues, verse number 7, he's talking to us here about Melchizedek. In the days of his flesh, he offered up prayers, supplications, vehement cries, and tears to him. The author goes on to talk about how he would like to tell us more about Melchizedek. Look at verse number 11. But why can he not say much more about Melchizedek here? Because you have become dull of hearing. So the writer says, I've got some whamma jamma points that I want to make about Melchizedek and Jesus. Jesus is a priest after the order, quote unquote, after the similitude of Melchizedek. Jesus is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. And the writer really wants to wow them with the points that he has to make along those lines, but he says, I can't do it yet because you're dull of hearing. We're going to, you probably know this, but we're going to get to those points in Hebrews chapter 7. Hebrews chapter 7. So we are going to have this conversation about Christ and Melchizedek. We're just not going to have it here in chapter 5. We're going to have it in Hebrews chapter 7. The writer is letting his readers know, it's a two cup of coffee morning if you want to talk to me about Melchizedek, because I've got some things to tell you about Melchizedek that you need to be all senses go for. And he says, I need to talk to you a little bit about growing as a Christian before we talk about Melchizedek. Look at verse number 12, Hebrews chapter 5, verse 12. Somebody, by the way, I'm doing a lot of reading. Somebody want to read Hebrews chapter 5, verse 12? So I love Hebrews chapter 5, verse 12 for a lot of reasons, right? The writer says, you should be teaching other folks this stuff, but you need to be taught it again. So that gives us some kind of time stamp onto the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews was written at such a point after the establishment of the church. The establishment of the church happens where, when, by the way? Right. Acts 2, AD 33, Jerusalem. So the writing of the book of Hebrews is at some sufficient point beyond that, where the writer says, not only should you know this, but you should be signing up folks to study this with, and you should be teachers, right? You know, I frequently make application from that to us today, because every congregation I know about, none of them are turning down teachers. Let me just put it that way, right? None of them are saying, you know what? We're taking down our sign-up sheet for teachers because we don't need them anymore. No one's doing that. Some congregations are in more of a crisis mode. We're not that here at Augusta Road, but some congregations need teachers more than others. But no congregation that I'm aware of says, you know what? We're going to just stop asking for teachers because we're good. No. And among the membership of churches that I'm aware of, there are some folks who say, I'm just not ready to do that yet. You know, there are a lot of people that say, I'm not ready to teach a Bible class yet, or I don't want to do that, or somebody else should do that. Well, I think we can make an application from Hebrews chapter 5, verse 12, that the Lord is looking to us to be teachers, and the Lord has a little clock above each of us that indicates to Him when we should have grown, by how much we should have grown. You know, spiritual growth is an interesting thing, because spiritual growth does not happen naturally. My two girls, Macy and Bailey, they're going to have birthdays in May. You know why? Because it's May. Because that's the way birthdays go, right? Every year, you have another one. You don't have to do anything, really, to have another birthday. You can't stop having another birthday. I know some folks would like to slow it down just a hair. You can't do that. You are a passenger in your physical growth. Physical growth happens just 'cause. You're another day older than you were yesterday for the simple fact that you woke up today. Tomorrow, you're going to be another day older than you are today for the simple passive fact that you woke up and got out of bed. You don't even have to get out of bed. You stay in bed, you still be another day older. This is going to happen. You're going to grow taller just 'cause, right? Your feet are going to get bigger just because. You reach a point where you stop getting taller and your feet stop getting bigger. But this growth, this physical growth just happens. Well, is that the way spiritual growth is? No. You can hear, believe, repent, confess, be baptized, and be a baby, spiritual baby, and you know You can stay that spiritual baby for a long time. You can't stay a physical baby for a long time. You're going to grow. You're a passenger in that physical growth. But you can hear, believe, repent, confess, be baptized, and be a spiritual baby. And you could stay that spiritual baby for how long? Somebody tell me. I mean, yeah, you could stay that spiritual babe in Christ for years, years. You know, you, with our kids and with ourselves, we go to doctors and they measure us and, you know, tell us how we're growing. And that growth, that physical growth is automatic. You know, it just happens. Spiritual growth is not automatic. It doesn't just happen. We have to contribute to this spiritual growth. In physical growth, we're the passenger. This thing's getting older and bigger without us. In spiritual growth, we're the driver. And if we don't get to driving, we're not going to grow spiritually. So Hebrews chapter 5, verse 12 lets us know that the Lord has expectations on us. He expects that there will come a point in time when we are able to be teachers. Now, we can be teachers in different ways. We can be teachers in Bible classes. That is a very level one, you know, frontline sort of way that we can be teachers. That's not the only way to be a teacher, though. You're teachers of your children, hopefully. You're teachers of your friends and your neighbors and your co-workers, hopefully. There's a group every Saturday morning that goes out to the flea market and passes out information and gets in religious discussions with folks there. You can be a teacher that way. You can be a teacher by standing up here and giving a devotional, or going to Atlanta at a Lads to Leaders meeting and giving a speech, or by becoming a preacher. You can be a teacher that way. Those aren't the only ways that you can teach. You can teach by grading Bible correspondence courses, by sending out these lessons, by sending notes, by sharing things on Facebook. There are a lot of ways to be teachers. But the point is that there comes a point in time where the Lord looks at us and says, okay, now you should be doing this. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Look at the... Well, I appreciate you making that point. Steve says it sounds like a commandment, like something that if you're not doing, you're doing something wrong. Yeah. Look at 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. Grow. Right? Grow. That's the commandment. That's in the imperative mood in the Greek language, which means it's imperative that you do it. It's a command. Grow. In the grace and in the knowledge. Sounds like a command, doesn't it? I appreciate you making that point. The time that you ought to be teachers, you need to be taught again. Now, here's another point I'd like to make from Hebrews chapter 5, verse 12, very quickly. They were not dinged. They were not knocked or criticized because they needed a teacher. Everybody needs a teacher, right? They were not criticized because they needed to be taught something. Because that's all of us. We all need to be taught something. I didn't take Hebrews class, the Hebrew language class, because I didn't want to do it. Because Greek almost drove me bonkers. And some people said Hebrew's a little harder than Greek initially, and then it gets a little easier. And I didn't want that. I wanted to take something else. So I did. I need a Hebrew teacher. it's okay to need somebody to teach you something. Nothing wrong with that. The nobleman said to Philip, "How can I understand this except some man should teach me?" So there's nothing wrong with needing a teacher. We all need teachers. Now, here's where it gets wrong. Their fault was not that they needed a teacher. Their fault was what they needed to be taught. It's not wrong for a senior in high school to need someone to teach him or her. It is wrong for a senior in high school to need someone to teach him or her the ABCs, right? And that's the point. That's the point that the writer's making here. Listen, we all need teachers. No one ever is going to get to the point where he says, you know, I've learned it all. I know some people who have learned everything they want to know. They have learned everything they want to know. They haven't learned everything they need to know, but they've learned everything they want to know. They've got their heads full with what they want to know, and then they flip the sign, you know, on one side it says open. They flip it over to where it says closed. They've learned everything they want to know. That's only going to get you so far. These people have learned everything they want to know. They haven't learned everything they need to know. They've learned everything they want to know. And so the writer says to them, no, not going to work like that. All righty, we will draw a line there. We will come back and finish chapter 5 and look at chapter 6 briefly, which will carry the same idea. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for listening to the Augusta Road Church of Christ. Located in Greenville, South Carolina, the Augusta Road congregation worships God in spirit and in truth in a friendly and loving environment. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for Augusta Road COC. And if you're ever in Greenville, South Carolina, we would love for you to come by for a visit.